hosts, Maya Monell and Aaron Papworth, founders of the Navit Money app, the money management app that uses behavioral science to foster financial wellness. In this episode, Aaron and I are so excited to sit down with our dear friend, Dustin Shea. Dustin is the Senior Director of Partnerships for Village Capital. In this role, he leads the development of critical partnerships among industry leaders to support their team's primary mission to create long-term prosperity and sustainability by backing the entrepreneurs of the future. He also supports the development of organizational strategy, serves as primary lead for all fundraising activities, and oversees the capture and organization of key impact metrics. Needless to say, he's a busy guy, and he knows everything about the topic we're discussing, wealth gaps. In his not-so-spare time, he's a venture partner at Republic, an advisor board member at Left Tackle Capital, and an advisory board member at Black Women Talk Tack. We promise you're going to love this episode, and it is the perfect way to tie up our second season. Thanks so much for joining us. Welcome back to the Navit podcast. Today, Aaron and I are thrilled to introduce you all to our dear friend and colleague, Dustin Shea. Dustin, welcome so much. Welcome to the show. We're so excited to have you.
I'm so excited to be here. And there's even more sirens than before.
So sorry. Okay, New York is also very excited to be here too.
New York's coming in hot.
Dustin has brought the entire police force and maybe fire department of New York City to our podcast today. So everybody will be super excited to hear the background noises. At least I am sitting here in a comfy, cozy Idaho setting. I'm excited to hear the dulcet sounds of Manhattan.
Big city, Maya.
Yes, big city. So Dustin, I want to dive right in by allowing you to tell the audience a little bit more about your background, you know, how you've landed at Village Capital, as well as the super, super duper impressive extracurriculars you have on your resume.
You're so very flattering, and I love it. So I'm Dustin Shea. I'm Senior Director of Partnerships with a group called Village Capital, which basically exist to support underrepresented founders that are solving really, really big issues and make sure that they have all of the capital and connections and resources they need to grow and scale their businesses. I'm also an advisor to a group called Black Women Talk Tech. It's a national network of supports around Black female founders. It's a great, wonderful organization that puts on a number of really cool conferences and other events. I also am an advisor to a group called Left Tackle Capital, which is think of it kind of like an accelerator for emerging fund managers. So people who are raising their first or second time funds who are women or people of color can go to Left Tackle Capital in order to get all of the training and support that they need and then network access that they need to be able to raise their funds. And then I'm also a venture partner with Republic, which is an online equity-based crowdfunding platform that allows anybody to be able to invest in privately held early stage companies, kind of like Navit. I'm happy to go through kind of how all of these things come together, but really they address different angles of the problem that I'm most passionate about, which is diversity and equity, and trying to create a more equitable economy. And with Village Capital, that happens by us directly supporting entrepreneurs. With Black Women Talk Tech, that means that, or that the reason I'm working with them is because they have an approach that helps people without necessarily them needing to sign up for a formalized program in order to get that support. Left Tackle Capital changes the demographics of investment, which is incredibly important because about over 80% of investment decision makers are white men, and about 90% of investment capital goes to men, less than 2 or 3% goes to Black and Latinx founders, and there's kind of a correlation there. So unless you change the demographics of the people making investment decisions, you won't change who is getting money. And then with being a venture partner with Republic, the goal is to help people kind of sidestep the entire bias system that is venture capital. To answer your question of how I got here, it's luck. It's luck and a system designed to work for white guys like me.
I think it has a little bit more to do than you give it credit for. You have more to do with it than you give it credit for.
Yeah, I worked hard. I'm not going to lie. I put my nose to the grindstone, and I got a great internship at the end of college with a group called the Sorensen Impact Foundation and the Sorensen Impact Center, where I learned how to do VC, and I got a really good understanding of how everything works. But really, like, I didn't work much harder than anybody else would have in my shoes. I just happened to be the beneficiary of a system literally designed to work for, you know, middle-class white guys. And here I am still, another middle-class white guy.
Well, I think a lot of the first of all, I don't know when Dustin sleeps in the day. So we are going to cover his at least typical 9-to-5 at Village Cap in a second, because I think that there's some learnings that you have attained during your time there that I think our audience would love to hear. But also, you know, just speaking quickly to the fact that you think it's all about luck. And I, granted, luck has a lot to do with anybody's success in life. But I think, you know, Dustin, you've been such an ally to Aaron and I and the growth of Navit, and frankly, from a friendship perspective as well. Like, you are so focused on bringing the voices to people that often don't feel they have a voice or haven't been given a voice in a system like you so well articulated, not built and designed for them. So I think that it has a lot to do with luck, but it also has a lot to do with who you are as a human being and that which drives you to get up and make an impact every day. And I think that's obviously seen through those extracurriculars. You know, those are some pretty impressive organizations that you devote your time to outside of your working day.
So basically, Dustin, if you're going to be a white man with luck, be like you, because yes, you pay it forward and you do the right thing with it and you do amazing. So we're very grateful.
Yeah. Well, thank my dad and my mom for instilling values in me, I guess. But the point, I think, is really, like, if you're going to be lucky enough to be in the position that I find myself in, I need to be leveraging that towards the values that I grew up with, which are, frankly, American dream kind of values, right? We're supposedly trying to live in a society where everybody can work hard and get ahead. And as you grow older, you see more of the world and you see more of the country, you start to understand that those systems are just not built and not in place for everybody. And so, my real driving sort of mission in life is to make them more accessible for everybody, because that's the country that I thought I lived in this whole time.
It's an incredible moment of realization. Yes, go ahead, Maya.
Completely. No, I was just going to say, you know, I'm for so many reasons, we're excited to dive into the work that you're doing, both in those extracurriculars and your time at VILCAP. And I'd love a chance to give the audience a chance to understand a little bit more about kind of the outcomes you've seen at VILCAP and your unique investing approach to support a lot of these founders that are often overlooked by the larger behemoth of early stage capital.
Sure. Well, Village Capital exists to unlock the power of entrepreneurship to solve really, really big problems. We support underrepresented entrepreneurs, we question traditional power dynamics, and we generate meaningful returns while we do it. And I think the thing that you were just alluding to, and one of the things that we're most well known for, is the peer selection methodology. The way that venture capital works, just to get really basic, is a bunch of old white guys sitting around. No. What happens is, you know, somebody starts a company and they try and scale up that company, and it takes a lot of money to start a company, right? The Kauffman Foundation estimates it takes on average about $30,000 to start a company. So you're already dealing with kind of like a stacked deck of cards as you're trying mm-hmm. to get started if you're a person of color, because your average white family has somewhere in the neighborhood of 100K net worth. Your average Black or Latinx family here in the US has less than $12,000. So if you are trying to start a company and you don't have a bunch of friends and family that you can go to get that initial $30,000, or you can't pull it out of, you know, your equity on your house or whatever, you're already kind of behind the eight ball, right? A village capital exists because we think that once you do get your company started, the barriers only get higher, particularly for companies that are operating in what we call the pioneer gap, right? So you've founded your company, you're starting to grow, and you're somewhere past like your very, very first little bit of investment and just trying to start getting your first institutional rounds together. And we come in during that pioneer gap because, frankly, that's where tons and tons of companies die. The thing that we do is we teach entrepreneurs how to evaluate each other as investors do. So we teach them a very clear kind of rubric of how do you evaluate one another? How do you evaluate the level of development of a team? How do you evaluate the level of development of a product or the market fit or what have you? And when we started in 2009, we thought, since we're teaching entrepreneurs how to evaluate each other as investors anyway, we might as well provide some additional support. And again, back 10 years ago, 11 years ago, this was totally radical, right? We were one of just a couple of groups that were out there in the world trying this cohort-based model of entrepreneur support. So we decided to evaluate how well that was actually working. And over the last 10 years, we've developed a process that's been shown to help entrepreneurs raise 3 times the capital, generate over 2x the revenue, and grow their teams about 50% faster. And at the end of these 3 to 5 month accelerator programs, as we've been putting them together, the entrepreneurs conduct that peer evaluation of one another. Really, they do that quite often over the course of any acceleration program that we run. But at the end is when it really counts, because that's when we actually distribute capital to the top 2 peer selected entrepreneurs from each group. And that peer selection is a total inversion of regular power dynamics, right? Usually what happens is the VC sits behind their desk and they look at a company for a couple minutes. Maybe an analyst does a couple of hours of really furious Googling and some interviews with the founders, and eventually says, looks good. At which point, people who are making the investment decision, again, mostly old white guys, say, yeah, I'll invest, or no, I won't. There's no regulation in all of this. All of this is totally wild, wild west. Anybody can do whatever they want. So we were founded on the idea that if we have entrepreneurs do this and leverage their own sort of lived experience with the problems they're solving, their lived experience with what it takes to be successful in the industry that they operate in every day, that we would make better investment decisions, more inclusive investment decisions, and frankly, more profitable investment decisions. Over the last 10 years, we've made about 110 investments using this peer selection methodology through an affiliated kind of partner fund that is run by the co-founder of Village Capital, a woman named Victoria Fram. And it's working. It's working really well. We've got about an 86% survival rate. Most of the founders we've invested in are outside of major venture hubs. It's about 36% Black and Latinx founders, and about 46% women-led companies. We've also had 17 early and profitable exits to date, which, if you're looking at the stage that we're operating in and the wide, wide sort of geographic footprint, we are a global mm-hmm. fund, and very distributed sectors and all of those things. We're blowing other funds out of the water. Maybe I should walk that back a little bit and say we are outperforming our vintage year for VC. And that's been really, really exciting to see.
It's really interesting. And I think the one thing that I think we miss in how these products that we use on a daily basis come to fruition, right? How Instagram that I use every day here, you know, like how these things happen is really in this sweet spot. Like this structure and system is the key to virtually like what, 75%
innovation.
Yeah, 75% of the things that we use on a daily basis. So this is so key that it's because, and you're identifying this kind of system has historically been hyper polarized and specifically skewed to one person. And the way that they make those decisions, I mean, risk, this is early stage money and investment, so it's risky. So the way that they have used, like they, you know, as you said, the Wild Wild West has figured out a system is pattern matching. That's what you're talking about. Like the white guy sees the other white guy, looks like him, remembers when he was an entrepreneur and says, oh, this guy reminds me, you know, of myself. I think he can do it. And so what 100%. You guys are doing, I mean, it's just so profound and that it has this effect on our, like the common woman's daily life.
Yeah.
So maybe you could speak a little bit to see what you see when different types of personalities come into the entrepreneurship world and what you see from a company perspective, like, are they solving problems that a white dude would never have thought of? Are they thinking about problems differently? Like, or are they typically just, like only focused on their own subsegment?
Yeah, I think I think Dr. Angela Jackson was just talking about this, right? It's proximal leadership. Entrepreneurship is a tool to solve a problem that you are familiar with, right? So you start a company because you see that there is a gap somewhere. Well, right now what's happening is overwhelmingly white dudes who see gaps in their daily lives are starting companies. And those gaps are things like, how do I get food from across the street into my apartment? Which is much more relevant in the COVID age than it was previously, but that's kind of like what we worry about. We worry about like, oh, how can I invest my money better, right? But real systems level innovation comes from the edges of where systems break down, right? So if you look at who systems are failing, systems like healthcare, education, the financial services system have been failing women and communities of color for a really, really long time. And so if you want to see real systems level innovation isn't going to come from like white dude who's like deep in a bank and he's looking at the bank. He's like, oh man, this is working so well. You know, it's going to come from people who have a terrible, terrible experience with these systems.
Yes.
People who are their own customers. And I think that is so key.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. If you're solving a problem that has affected your community, chances are there's dozens, hundreds of other communities across the country and around the world that are struggling with those same problems. And so we see that lived experience as absolutely vital in entrepreneurs that we're looking to support as Village Capital.
I love it. And that tees us up so brilliantly into this main part of the conversation, which is just a, you know, small minor thing to talk about, the issues of wealth gaps. We'll probably lean towards the US system just because we're all in it and we know it best, but certainly wealth gaps exist of all kinds across the world. And Dustin is so knowledgeable into this topic, so we would be remiss if we did not focus on it when we had him on the show today. So Dustin, let's start off super simple. Why do these wealth gaps exist in our country?
Super, super simple, right?
Super simple, like, yeah.
There's a million hours and takes and directions and questions that people have when they start diving into this topic. But why do wealth gaps exist?
You didn't know that this was going to be an entire new season? Like, we're just going to keep rolling for the next 10 hours. Is that cool?
Great.
Okay, cool. Great. All right, cool.
So there's a couple of people we need to bring in here, like Matt Stoller, right?
Yeah.
Just everybody should come and hang out. That's an economist for normal people who don't know with these things, because why would you? So why do wealth gaps exist? Capitalism, that's why wealth gaps exist in our country. This is an economic system that was designed to accrue wealth to the top of a pyramid through the systematic exploitation of some population, right? In the USA, that is any non-white, non-male, non-landholding population. And everyone's had a turn, right? Like this started with subjugating indigenous Native American people whose lands we like literally stole. Then black people who were literally enslaved, Chinese people who were subjugated and died by the thousands to build our rail infrastructure across the country. And Latinx folks who have long held some of the most taxing jobs in our agricultural and food systems. We live in a market economy that was literally designed, and I don't think people think about this very often, but it was designed to reinforce power dynamics as they've existed for hundreds of years. And you can see that playing out, even in America, the land of opportunity or whatever. If you look at the last 50 years, families at the bottom of the wealth pyramid, families in the bottom 10% of wealth holders in the country, have gone from having no money to having negative money. They went from zero average wealth to an average of negative $1,000. Meanwhile, if you're in the top 10%, you've seen over the last 50 years, your wealth quintuple. It's gone up by 5 times. And if you're in the top 1%, it's gone up by 7 times. And that's not talking about the gap between them. That's just talking about growth in that last 50 years, right? Mm-hmm. It's been so crazy. And overwhelmingly, these changes have benefited white families who now have about 8 times the wealth of the median black family. And about 5 times the wealth of the average Latinx family. There's a series of really cool charts that you can look up around all of these things that I am saying. I'm not just pulling numbers out of nowhere. You should check out urban.org. And they've got I can even just say the URL. It's /features/wealth inequality charts. There you go. This is the
we'll
whole
put box. It in the show notes.
Yeah.
We'll put it in the show notes.
Great, yeah. That'll be perfect. But really, some of the biggest drivers of this intergenerational wealth inequality are access to good jobs, good educational opportunities, equal pay, and the income gap grows over time. It's not just that, you know, you start off and it's a gap and it just kind of stays there. No, it actually gets much, much worse the older you get. And that's kind of like intuitive, right? I mean, oftentimes you'll see when white families or white men in particular get really good jobs, one of the things that defines a good job, right, is a lot of upward mobility in that job. And that means that they're going to be earning more and more and more over time. Meanwhile, you see this kind of systematic exclusion at the higher ranks of people of color and of women. And that income gap, which grows over time, makes it really harder to invest in real assets that stick around for a while and make the next generation better, like stable housing, like home ownership is way different in terms of rates of home ownership between white families and any other families across the US, but particularly Black and Latinx families really struggle on this front. And without that strong base to start from, it makes it harder to retire. And so all of these things, it all comes back to capitalism is problematic if you're trying to eliminate wealth gaps, or at least this weird, very strange version of capitalism that we've given ourselves, which is a particularly brutal form, I think, of capitalism.
From the historical context, it's really fascinating. And it begs me to ask you this next question: with the rise in technology, with the impact and influence of, you know, say early stage VCs like Bill Kapp and other organizations that are really are trying to make an imprint and make a change in this larger issue. I can't say that I necessarily see a light at the end of the tunnel. So I want to talk a little bit about why these gaps continue to persist. I mean, certainly Erin and I can talk about it from the female perspective, and like, you know, we've been both called the minority in front of you with somebody else. We've all been at a party. Side note, context: we've been called the minority card, which, you know, everybody knows Erin and I are, you know, admittedly privileged white women. Like that, we should not be the minority card, but we're still seen as such. And I just use us as an example because it's obviously the closest to home. Why these gaps intrinsically still exist in the most powerful, most innovative, most everything country in the world.
But I do think, and a country that has some sort of deeper, like you say, your American values, like my American values were, you know, that equality thing. Like I could be anything I wanted to be if I worked hard, put my nose down. Like, and that is intrinsic in the DNA of the American, like the immigrant pop, you know, we are, I mean, other than the exploitation of Native and Indigenous people, like there is this like counterbalance of there should be opportunity. I think that's why we get so indignant about it, because the DNA is like, the structure doesn't allow upward mobility, but we are taught that it should.
But this is also, and I think Dustin will maybe talk about this, but this is also the problem with how our American dream has transformed into a meritocracy. And therefore excludes. Well, you go into that. Yes.
Yeah.
Let's ask the question to you. You're the expert.
Sorry, I shouldn't have interrupted. But no, also, like really, it's so super not a meritocracy. And it never had been, right? You can read anything. You go to the People's History of the United States and you can read about how from the very, very beginning it wasn't a meritocracy. You can read Monopoly or what, no, it's Goliath, right? The 100-year war between monopoly and democracy. You can read these things, they're out there. These people are geniuses and much more eloquent than I will ever be, but mostly the gaps that we see have persisted because of a system of benefits designed around building assets for higher income people. Retirement plans, for example, disproportionately are available to and benefit people who are in the top 20% of earners. And it's the same thing with homeownership policies, like the mortgage tax deduction, right? Like that only helps if you're able to get a mortgage, you know? The number one reason we have continued massive wealth gaps in our country is because our lawmakers are relatively gutless when it comes to regulating the financial industry. It hasn't always been this way, but it has been increasingly this way over the past 80 or so years. We don't recognize anymore in this country that corporate power is power. And instead, we invite them to regulate themselves and to, frankly, buy the regulation that they want to see. And you can see that in the regulatory laws that we have now. And again, in the policies that we have now. Like, there's no reason that venture capital should be the wild, wild west that it is. There's also limited reason that we should be investing in everything and anything as long as it makes money and regardless of the environmental or social costs associated with it. There's a rising movement around maybe appropriately valuating the externalities of your investment, which is generally referred to as impact investing. Sometimes referred to, there's ESG is another thing that's kind of like impact adjacent, right? It's been a process that the financial industry has been going through, but there's no reason that we shouldn't be, absolutely no reason that we shouldn't be regulating. I think it's a matter of real political will. But they also, if you want to get to a more actionable set of questions.
Yes, we do, and you'll tee us up for the positive stuff.
Yeah, I mean, they also exist because we as a society stifle meaningful innovation by not supporting innovation coming from and by communities of color. We're just excluding a massive portion of innovation in our society and innovators in our society.
Yeah, completely.
Go
ahead, Erin.
Is that the solution? Yeah, I mean, capitalism, I feel like structurally would be very hard to roll back in this country, but meaningful regulation and thoughtful governance is something that can change, like, you know, move the tide on this. So I would love, I would love your perspective on like the actionable items that are logical and also realistic, because I think when you get to the extremes, you know, like you can go to the extreme of like, well, fuck cast, you know, I can use this because it's our podcast, right? Like, yes. Fuck capitalism, let's do socialism, which is like in the current kind of conversation, that also doesn't seem logical to me. Like you can't like totally destroy one system for another, but you can move the dial. And that's what we've been doing for the 300 years that we've been in existence, right? You swing different ways and you kind of find the center somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And there's no reason that capitalism shouldn't be effectively regulated and reined in to be a much more robust system for that works for everybody, right? Right now, I think there's a couple of people that say that American capitalism is a really interesting sort of phenomenon, in that it's brutal capitalism for anybody who is in the bottom 60% of earners. And then for those at the top and the top 20%, it is just super socialist. It's crazy how much goes into supporting and protecting that top 20% and a little bit the top 40%, but mostly the top 20% and really the top 5% more than anybody else. But in order to really overcome kind of these persistent wealth gaps, we need to use every single tool that we have in the toolbox. And I need to be like perfectly clear about that. We need to use stronger regulation. We need to use philanthropic support. We need to use massive corporations with aligned values, and we need to support entrepreneurial innovation. But in the current reality that we occupy, the darkest timeline that looks like it might be getting a little bit brighter soon, but is still currently the darkest timeline. Our government lacks the political will to solve the problem. And philanthropy, frankly, is a drop in the bucket when compared to capital markets. And so we have to leverage the scalable power of entrepreneurship as a stopgap to start to address some of these really big systemic gaps. And we need to support innovations like Navit and others like Navit, that are built by people that have been historically let down by the systems that we have in place, and that were built for land-owning white men. And we need to incentivize big corporate actors that have values. We need to incentivize them to have values first, and then we need to help them live by those values. One of the groups that's doing it right, that's out there right now, is PayPal, right? And we can get into all of the cool things that PayPal has done on this front to try and address some of these really meaningful gaps, not just within their company, but outside of their company. But they are definitely a group that I would put near the top of that pedestal of like, that's the kind of thing that we should be supporting in our country.
So I want to drill down on one topic here, because I think, I really think because of the political landscape, we have to do this. When you say regulation, and then in the same sentence you say, and invest in meaningful innovation and entrepreneurship, you know, people have historically felt like, I mean, and like, you know, especially the Republican Party has said those two things are not aligned. But when you're talking regulation, you're not saying, you know, to totally, you know, force them to have a socialized, you know, medicine system or do it one way. What you're saying is aligning the government, the tax, the, you know, overall like employment regulation, labor laws, to incentivize the company to act in the good of the social structure. So like one example that I'm thinking of is we helped Senator Wyden from Oregon propose into, you know, the Senate, and it was like probably a year and a half ago now, tax incentives for, you know, the angel investors, which of course are the one percenters, to invest in female and minority entrepreneurs. So giving those people a tax incentive. It's not the best way. It still is that 1%, you know, reinforcement. But what it's trying to do is circulate the investment capital into entrepreneurs that are underrepresented. So could you kind of talk a little bit more about that? Because when you say, I think we have to be careful when we say regulation, that we don't, it's not clickbaity, and we really think meaningfully about how, what you're talking about there.
Yeah. So like that is one example of, like, regulation is an infinitely complex thing, right? That's one example of a really good policy that would be great to implement. And I'm so, so glad that you guys were on the tip of the spear pushing for that and that it went through. That's fantastic. But you did highlight something that I do need to say. I am very much in support of a socialized medical system. And one of the biggest reasons behind that is because 67% of bankruptcies in America come from medical debt and from lack of employment due to an illness or some sort of a medical emergency. And if you just remove that, one barrier from us being able to unlock the power of innovation within our own economy, like, you're really starting to fire on all cylinders, right? I don't ascribe to the belief that if you have people living like normal, like relatively comfortable lives, that they wouldn't continue to innovate. That's not what I'm saying.
Totally. I think the one thing for me that makes social that complicated is that you have to also then figure out the pharmaceuticals and the insurance. It can't just be the medical structure, because there's so many more factors to it. So if I agree, like, it, we absolutely need to solve the medical system problem. And 100%, we see that in our world with, you know, our users with tax, I mean, with, like, meaningful medical bills. But again, it's not a one, like, this is what I'm trying to say. It's like, not this one sweeping, like, socialized medicine done, like, magic.
No, there's so much more that goes into that,
like,
right?
So much more complicated. And you need, and you have these industries like insurance and pharmaceuticals that have to also be mission aligned, like, have to also be a part of this, or it's not going to solve the problem just by, like, telling the states to give free medicine, you know? Yeah.
Which is, to Dustin's point, how we have to activate and improve the ways in which we incentivize and work with for-profit institutions, just like maybe we have nonprofit institutions, to get them to come to the table and make them more mission aligned to these larger systemic issues and therefore goals. So I do want to, I mean, Dustin, you spoke a little bit about PayPal, and I want to talk more about this kind of intersection of philanthropic and corporate partnerships. And certainly you're seeing both the nonprofit and the for-profit come together. And I think PayPal is a great example of that. And I wanted to give you a chance to speak more towards some of those examples and how you've seen it actualized right now.
Yeah, totally. And just to be clear, like, what the big tie-in here is that Village Capital is a 501c3. We are a nonprofit. We do all of this work because we want to make a better functioning market and see the impact that these companies have. And we are wonderfully, wonderfully subsidized by them. Among many people and organizations who are partners of ours, PayPal is one of our many partners. This isn't meant to us to say that I'm just being a shill for PayPal. I do need to note that. But they are doing some things that are really, really good. And I'm sure that there are other groups that are out there that are doing things that are really, really good too. I just happen to know more about PayPal because I talk to them all the time. So a couple things that PayPal has done. One of them is normalizing income for the financial health of their workers. They went through and they did this entirely voluntarily. They looked at the financial health of every one of their workers kind of across all of PayPal, and they're a global organization. This was not a minor undertaking. Dan Schulman has an axe to grind around financial health, and it's clear because he talks about it all the time. Mm-hmm. And he went through this process. What they found, and they thought they were going to be so, so good, in terms of providing, like, a meaningful income for all of their employees, because they were at or above market everywhere. What they found was that the net disposable income of some of their workers was, like, under 10%. It was, like, under 6% for some of them, right? And particularly, like, customer success folks who are who are on the front line of trying to deal with people who are angry about not being able to log into their PayPal, right? And who are critical for the success of their company. And they, again, I can't stress this enough, completely voluntarily set in place a plan to normalize and improve the financial health of every one of their employees, at least get their employees to 20% net disposable income. They have been doing this for the past couple of years now, sort of ramping folks up over time. And I think that the lowest that they have right now is somewhere in the 15 or 16%. They're not stopping till they hit 20% net disposable income, which is the measure of how much of your income you have left after taxes, food, housing, all of those sorts of things. And not to say that's where somebody should stop, right? But that is exceptional. Really, really cool.
100%. How, so are they doing that through increasing income or?
Yeah. Increasing income, improving employee benefits, the whole nine yards. They've been really doing some great work. And that's not the only thing that they've been doing. You know, they've been really leveraging everything they can. So think of that as like internal governance, right? They've also been leveraging their products. So PayPal is one of the largest small business lenders in the US. And I don't know why this isn't a bigger story, but they've provided literal billions of dollars to small businesses across the US without them having to rely on a FICO score in order to get that money, which I need to triple, quadruple underline is such a huge, huge thing because so many small businesses have terrible, awful, no good credit scores and overly rely on the credit score of the entrepreneur that is leading that business anyway, right? They also don't have like a ton of assets and banks look at them and say, ha ha, never, ever, ever shall I give you a loan because why would I? You look like a terrible group to lend money to on paper. But what PayPal does is they use the actual transaction history if that shop has used PayPal as like their point of sale service or whatever. And they then lend money through this this tool called working capital, and they get paid back as a portion of the revenue stream of that small business. And so if you don't make any money in a month, you don't have to pay PayPal anything in a month, which is great. And is much more flexible for that small business. And the reason that that's important is like we talk about venture capital a lot, right? But 83% of entrepreneurs out there don't raise money from a formal financial institution or VCs. The vast, vast majority of them are trying to make it happen with a brick and mortar company or a brick and mortar storefront, maybe a small online company or something like that. And they're not a good fit for venture capital and the banks just can't lend to them.
I think creditworthiness, speaking back to our key topic here of wealth gaps, is one of the fundamental persisting issues with wealth gaps in our country, and certainly a topic Aaron and I are trying to solve. So thanks so much for teeing that last question up, Dustin. And I want to give you a chance before we conclude and run into our rapid fire round. You know, from your perspective, we've talked a lot and there's a lot more to uncover and unpack. I'm sure we'll see you back in season 3. Thanks ahead of time for agreeing to that. And, you know, where do we go from here, from your own perspective? Again, I like simple questions. Yeah.
It's super, super simple, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think where we need to go from here is, I mean, there's so many different directions that we need to go all at the same time, which is the unfortunate reality that we find ourselves in with a lot of sticky problems. One of the things that I think we need to be doing more of is lifting the voice of people who are systemically overlooked. We can't keep moving forward just saying like we're going to listen to some of the richest, whitest people in America. And if you look I hate to steal your talking points, Aaron, but if you look at the Republican Party, like the vast, vast, vast majority of them are white men. And those who are not white men are often white women. And if you look at the demographic breakdown of the Democratic Party, not to say that they're like on the right track about literally everything, but at least it's representative. And we need to effectively lift the voices and experiences of those that are left out of the systems that most of us, most of people like me, white dudes who live in New York City and other major urban centers around the US, like, we need to lift the experience of people who aren't us. Because if we're not paying attention, we will never, ever, ever be able to solve these things. And we need to come to grips and actually admit that there is a real, real problem with power distribution in this country. And that, again, unless we're actually paying attention to people that we haven't paid attention to as a country, as a society, you know, we're just never going to solve the problems. And we need to speak openly about that, right? Wealth gap or opportunity gap or whatever other gap you want to highlight.
Yeah, and I really appreciate you bringing up PayPal, because I think this is like building on these different conversations. But in light of the fact we don't have good leadership at the political level incentivizing corporations to have, you know, to consider their social impact and have good governance, it really does come down to the individual contributor. And PayPal is an excellent example of how leadership, like a white dude at the top, I'm assuming, but you said his name, right? A white dude at the top has made this conscious decision that this is a priority for him. And he's still running an incredibly exceptional and profitable business while doing the right thing in his corporate governance. And I think that is really inspiring, and that it gives a roadmap for other people to be better. And they don't have, not at a loss or a net loss to them. It's they are creating abundance by thinking through what is their direct impact and how they can align their company incentives with social incentives. And you're just going to get a better workforce when you do this. And I think in light of the fact we don't know what's happening in the craziness of our leadership, that is a really tangible action item for people.
Yeah. And I want to tease that out just a little bit, because you followed back up with this, which was important, but it's not that they are running a super profitable and great business that is generating crazy returns and its stock price is near the top of where it's ever been right now, you know, while they are doing social impact good stuff. Right. It's because they are doing
good point. Yes, perfect.
They've just made a $530 million commitment. $30 million of that is philanthropy. That can be the while they're doing good stuff, right? $500 million of that is explicitly designed to support Black and Brown founders. $400 million going to community lending institutions like CDFIs and credit unions that are disproportionately focused on providing that first capital for somebody to start a business or whatever. And $100 million going into differently led funds, so funds that are led by women and people of color. And that's just so meaningfully important. And such a huge step. You've seen a lot of this happen around the corporate sphere over the past, you know, year, right? And particularly since the killing of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and so many others. You see a lot of groups stepping up to make a change, but I don't think you see anybody stepping up at the level that PayPal is of their assets as an organization. $500 million for PayPal is so much different than $100 million from Google, right? It just shows the depth of the commitment that they are making to this. And frankly, if we are able to incentivize more, and if PayPal can serve not as the exception, the super cool, out there, crazy organization, if we can help make that more of the rule, we'll be in a much better place as a society.
100%.
What a beautiful way to sum up this first episode with Dustin Shea. Dustin, we truly can't thank you enough for coming onto the show. This is a topic that we really enjoy discussing because it is so impactful to our society and our development. And frankly, everybody out there, we're really looking forward to certainly having Dustin back to dive more into some of the complexities of wealth gaps, but also focus on this topic in season three. So we'll be gone for the holidays, but we'll be back to launch season three. And I think Aaron and I feel really confident about diving more strongly into this persistent issue and topic across the country and across the world. Dustin, we have to go through our rapid fire round before we let you go. So 100%. rapid fire, these questions are asked to every guest we have on the show. First one being, what money stereotypes do you think society must overcome?
I have so many answers to this, but a couple of these are that money is a socially bad thing to talk about. We will not be able as a society to get better if we continue to have this weird trepidation around talking about money. Another big stereotype is that we make all of our money because of hard work. That's not true, 100% untrue. And we need to recognize that, because the reason that somebody is poor is not often due to only their own choices. And that spending is good. Spending is not great. You should try to avoid spending when you can. I can't believe I have to say this, but but you should probably try not to spend all of your money. And that's a very, very privileged thing to say. I'm able to say that because I have a livable income. But for those of us that do have livable incomes, you really shouldn't be in the 87%, I think, of Americans that are living paycheck to paycheck. You should be really trying to live within your means.
Completely. I love it. So,
but that solves the wealth gap.
It does not.
I mean, in some way, like for you, not totally, but you know, if you are able to save, then you have more access to credit. You have more access to, you know, depending on the structure. Yes, I know, and the person, but that, I mean, you just, when you have a cushion, you also have better credit and you have better access to other wealth generating opportunities.
Yeah. 100%. That's so true.
So how do you define a healthy money mindset?
I don't know how to define a healthy money mindset other than to say that, think of it, you know, you guys use a really wonderful way of thinking about money mindsets and financial mindsets and financial performance, right? Because you relate it back to high performance athletes. And if you take that same kind of approach and you think of it as an athlete does, often with their own diet in particular, of a calories in, calories out sort of methodology of, oh, I need to know that I am expending X number of calories and taking in Y number of calories. That actually comes back to another fintech term of cash in, cash out for like remittance, yep. Right? But aside from this, like, think of your money as your fuel to exist in this society. Unfortunately, that's the way it is. You guys might be able to tell more about my political leanings there, but unfortunately, that's the way it is. So please, like, think of calories in, calories out, cash in, cash out, and think of how you're living and try to understand that your daily expenses are only your daily expenses, and that there's always going to be something else that comes up. There's always going to be something else that you want to save for, that you want to do. And so if you're living right at the edge of your means, you're really doing yourself a disservice in the long run, and you're really not at where your means are if you're living at the edge of your paycheck.
Completely. So last but not least, Dustin, when was the last time you financially nabbed something, and how did you do it?
I moved to New York.
That works.
They come up on 2 years ago. And one of the things that I was in a very lucky position, as I have been in my entire life, I was in a very lucky position coming from up from DC, and I did not have to move for any other reason than I really, really wanted to live in New York more than DC. And because I had that opportunity, I got to sit down and I got to have a really open conversation with my partner. And we got to talk about every weird piece of living in New York? How long is it going to take to find a job? How much is rent going to be? What is it going to be? Like, we got to talk about freaking everything. And I think that this is one of the most important things that you can ever do if you're in a relationship with somebody. There's a whole podcast dedicated to freaky stories around this called This Is Uncomfortable. I strongly recommend it for your listeners if they haven't listened to this already. But there's a whole series of financial horror stories of you keeping things from your partner. If you're in a committed relationship, any financial decision you make that is above a couple hundred dollars, and this is very dependent on your income, you need to be having a real conversation with your partner to say, this is what we're doing, right? Are we really cool about this? So she and I, we got to sit down, and I think we spent an entire weekend talking this through, and then several months of planning around everything else. We literally mapped out our monetary lives and tried to understand how much is it actually going to cost to live in New York City. And when she said that she was cool with us moving up here, even though it would mean eventually splitting from the job that she had in DC, she went through and found out what's the average time that it takes to find a new job in New York. And we had a conversation about how I would need to take on more of and almost all of the expenses of our household in order to be able to make this move. And I think that was the last time I navigated something that was really challenging on the money front. But it was challenging because we actually ended up spending much longer than we thought trying to find her a new job. And that was hard, but because we had spent all of this time planning and had these really robust conversations on the front end, wasn't really a problem. Like, we had planned for it. We were ready to handle it. And again, super privileged place to be, to have the time and the money and the mental bandwidth to actually think through all of those issues. But that was the last time I navigated.
What an incredibly bonding.
Beautiful.
Yeah, and like, your relationship is 10 times stronger for it. Like, it's an incredible thing to have navigated together, and it must have felt very fulfilling to navigate that well.
It did.
Yes.
Yes. What a great way to end. Dustin, thank you so much for your time today. I mean, we are endlessly thankful for your allyship, your friendship, your support in what Aaron and I are doing, and vice versa to everything that you're doing. I mean, we're so proud to know you and have you on the show for certainly. Would you like to give everybody a handle or two of how to reach you? I'm sure a lot of our listeners would love to reach out with questions if you take any of them. You do not have to.
I will
cut this part out.
I'll take anybody's questions, but if you expect me to be active on social media, that's awful. I'm sorry. I'm terrible in that I don't do Twitter or anything like that. So just email me. My real life email is dustin@vilcap.com. It is dustin@vilcap.com. You can email me questions. I will likely respond to you. Feel free to ping me again if I don't respond to you. I'm happy to talk about all sorts of stuff. If it takes me a while, I'm sorry.
No, that's so sweet. We will add the email to the show notes, and we'll also add some of the resources that you've mentioned here, as well as your extracurriculars, because I bet our listeners will want to learn some more about the great work and keep up with you and the great work that you're doing. So thank you again for joining us. Everybody out there, thank you for joining us. And we will talk to you all soon. Thanks, Dustin.
Thank you.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Care to continue the convo? You can connect with fellow navigators in the app or on our Let's Navit Facebook page. Oh, and be sure to get social with us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Let's Navit. That's LetsNavit. And finally, wherever you're listening to this podcast, it would really help us if you would take a minute to rate, review, and subscribe. That's it for today's episode. Until next time. Let's Nab It!